Welcome to Sounds of the Bazaar, live internet radio, live from Online Educa Berlin. Online Educa is probably the biggest educational technology conference in Europe. There's something like 2,200 people here. It's big, it's confusing, it's mad. There's lots of friends walking by, we're waving. We're in the lobby of the hotel, broadcasting live radio to you. And we're going to try, if you can't be here at the conference, to bring you some of the best ideas, the best things, the talking points of this year's show. One of the big talking points is media. Suddenly, media has become big. 3 years ago, it didn't happen. Now everybody wants to be a video star. Everyone wants to be a radio star. And you can be like us. But anyway, Sarah Finch is a far bigger name than us because she's had three workshops yesterday. And as I understood it, because I tried to sign up for one of them, they were all sold out. And now Jen's going to talk to her to find out what's the secrets of her popularity. Over to you, Jen.
Hi, Sarah. Can you just give people like me who weren't at your workshop just a quick rundown on what you're actually doing there?
What I was trying to do was help people feel comfortable in front of video. People are comfortable speaking to one another, but one has to find that same comfort and ease in front of the camera. Because if you're not at ease in front of the camera, then the people who receive the information won't necessarily receive it fully. And that's all about relaxation. It's about enjoyment. It's about loving the camera. So this was partly making friends with the camera.
It sounds absolutely terrifying. I mean, apart from the fact I've got a great face for radio, this is why I don't do video. I mean, I can't think of anything worse, actually. However, so I'm doing radio. Have you got any tips for me?
Always make sure that your voice comes from the depths of you. I always say that the stomach is really the seat of our emotions, and it's from there that we must speak, it's from there that we must communicate. Because if we communicate from there, we'll be perceived as being truthful because it comes from the depths of our being.
Give me something to do then. Go on, I'm going to practice this.
Oh, right. Well, I'm afraid I'd probably have you jumping up and down doing relaxation exercises, feeling the tension and relaxation. And I made them all laugh a lot by doing a very silly exercise where you have to put two fingers between your teeth and then try and speak. Yes.
Okay, I'm trying to do this now. I feel a bit silly, but...
Yes. Then what you do is you do that and you say something quite challenging, like, my name is Jenny, and then you take your fingers away, say it again, and you'll suddenly find that you've opened your throat. You've tricked your throat into being open.
Okay, we'll give that a go then. So I put two fingers in my mouth, like this.
Go, my name is Jenny. Take it out, speak.
My name is Jenny.
That's very nice.
Does that work?
Yes, it does. And the thing was, I got one of them to be a guinea pig, a brave person, and people could really hear the difference in her voice. And it gives a rounder tone, and that makes it easier to listen to, and therefore easier to take on the information. Because otherwise, it's like having a check. You get given the check, but unless you cash it, i.e. unless you pass on the information in a good way, it won't be received, the check won't be cashed.
So are most of your audiences, the people that you work with, are they people who are appearing on television or making training videos? Who are they?
Well, actually, my principal work is to work as an actress and theatre director. But in being a director, people then have used me to teach teachers, to do presentation workshops. So my life is very varied, but probably the heart of my life is actually theatre acting and directing. But I love this as a sideline, and I love communication, and I love helping people to communicate better.
What were your students like yesterday? I mean, how did you judge whether it had worked yesterday? Did they all have to do a performance?
I really didn't want them to feel under any pressure to do a performance. So we did telling each other stories and then telling the same story in a group of four. And then suddenly I looked around and they were like a group of people, not doing an exercise I'd given them, but chatting. And then I said, okay, now just do that same thing, but in front of a camera. And one person who had really terrified of it, she suddenly looked so relaxed in front of the camera. It was, you know, it was lovely to see. They were great students. They were so open to do the stupid things I asked them to do and to play along. So they were great. And if it worked well, it was down to them.
Well, that's really nice of you to say so. I've met two people from the workshop. They were absolutely bowled over by it. They felt really good about it, so that was good. Really nice feedback. So I need to go in a moment, but I'm still going to pick your brains, because let's go back to radio. Do you do any radio acting?
Oh, yes, I do. In fact, well, I'm being interviewed next week for the BBC because I've just been working in Cuba. But I've also done radio plays and a number of interviews when I've been touring and things like that. And again, the same rules apply. Just be relaxed. Be open. That's the most important thing. Be open and let your audience feel that you're going out to meet them, then they'll come and meet you. And then it's a happy partnership.
Sarah, thanks very much indeed. We've got so many guests this morning. I'd love to stop and chat for an awful long time. I'll catch you at coffee.
Thank you, Jenny.
Yes, this is Sounds of the Bazaar. And it's all moving and grooving here. We actually have a queue of guests winding up to get on the purple sofa. And now it's Wilfred Rubens talking to Jen. And Jen's looking very entrenched on that sofa. And Wilfred's going to talk to her about data, sexy stuff. Jen, away you go.
I'm not looking nervous, I'm looking terrified, because Wilfred's going to talk about analytics. I haven't got a clue what that means. Can you just beam me up, Scotty? Tell me what it's all about.
Well, one of the most recent trends in e-learning is that we have the capability about that we not only have the possibilities to gather a lot of data, but that we also have tools to analyze this data, and that is called learning analytics, and it can be used for reflection on how learning takes place. It can be used for feedback for the student. It can be used as feedback for the teacher. So that is more or less what learning analytics is.
Can you give me an example? So you said it could be used to analyze how learning takes place. Like how?
For example, everything that you are doing in the learning management system is tracked, it's traced. And so you can see what kind of learning activities a student has been on. For example, how much time he spent on watching online videos, etc. And so you can say, well, your grades are low, but you also haven't watched the instruction video. So that's an example. So you can analyze patterns of behavior in online systems. But it has several difficulties, and it has also very important shortcomings. And that is what I am worrying about, that we misuse data, that we don't have the knowledge how to interpret data in a proper way. And what we also see is that large learning service providers own the data. They are not always very transparent what they are doing with the data. The data is not owned by the student. So there are a lot of issues to solve yet.
There seem to be massive ethical issues here. It's all a bit Big Brother. I mean,
no, it's critics always compare big data with 1984 George Orwell. But a colleague of mine, Peter Sloop, he once said, well, I'm not so worried about 1984, but I'm more worried about Kafka. And he said, because the biggest risks of big data is that we interpret the data in the wrong way, so that we draw the wrong conclusions, that we not ask the right questions before we are analyzing big data. And I think that risk is much larger than the risk of 1984.
I agree with you, but how do the students feel about it? I mean, three questions in one here. Do you actually do this in your own institution? And second, do the students know, and how do they feel about it?
Yes, we also analyze data. We analyze data because we use the data to improve our education. So I don't say that it's wrong to do it, but you must be transparent. And we inform our students what we are doing with our data. I think we can improve this because if you see all these rules, it's very complicated often to analyze what institutes are doing now with data, but I think that we tell students before how we are using data, but I think every institute can be more transparent in it and more clear and can tell it in a more simple way than we do now.
And where do you think this is going in the future? I mean, we're already doing this stuff. What's going to happen next, do you think?
Yeah, one of the risks is that technology, that we have more technological possibilities than we have, you could say, rules or agreements on how we are using this data. So I think you can't stop this development, you shouldn't stop the development, but you have to regulate. So I think that, and I don't believe in self-regulation by learning service providers, by companies. So I think that the complete branch, but including, for example, governments like European Union, they should have rules how data should be used and how data shouldn't be used. So there should be rules, it should be obliged to be transparent. And what I think is very important is that the student is owner of the data and that the data is not owned by large companies.
Large companies who potentially could sell it.
Yeah, they can sell it or they can use it to sell other services. And I think that you should be very careful with it.
Wilfred, thanks very much. I've learned a lot. I hope everybody else has. We've got so many people this morning. It's brilliant.
This is Sounds of the Bazaar live from Online Educa Berlin. We're going to have a short musical break to change over on the sofa, actually, and then we'll be back talking to June Brevik from Norway.
In the mountain, away from good stuff. The days of heavy rain.
Yes, one of the innovations we have this year at Online Educa Berlin is we sort of got a mini studio almost. But last night I saw Rebecca, who is one of the conference organiser, and she said to me, "Graham, how do you like your new spot? We've given you a sofa." And I said, "Rebecca, you're a lovely woman. I love this purple sofa." And so we're sitting on the sofa. I'm sitting here with Una, I think it is in Norwegian, in English, June. So we'll call you Una, yeah? From Norway, for I think the business school?
Yeah, the Norwegian business school.
Yeah. And I met Una last year, this year, ooh, time flies, at an event in the south of Norway. And at that time, she was saying, "I can't tell you anything about what's happening, but there's going to be a big report coming out about MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses, for the Norwegian government. I can't tell you what's in the report, but it's going to be cool and good." So now you can tell me what's in the report, and you can tell me what you think about Massive Open Online Courses. It's a big subject at this year's conference.
The report was the government wanted to put massive digital online learning in context to the existing education system, and they wanted some advice about policy making on this subject. So that is basically what the commission did. We said something about how MOOCs fit into the existing system, how it challenges the existing system, and what the government should do to meet these challenges.
Great. And what did you tell them? The whole Norwegian government, which we know has probably got more money for education than any other country in Europe, what did you tell them that they should be doing?
The previous talker was talking about big data and learning analytics, so we recommended that we had an institution that look into that. We also looked upon how we could implement MOOCs and take advantage of MOOCs within the existing system. And as far as we see it, there are no formal limitations to doing it. It's more how the institutions protect themselves. And that is whether you take a course on MOOCs online or if you take a course from another school. And also we have the challenges about funding, because contrary to the American system where you pay to go to school, in Norway education is free and you get grants. But it's limited to location, where you stay. But if you take MOOCs, it sort of opens up to the whole world, and that will challenge the entire funding system for higher education.
And the answer?
The answer? What? We didn't give any answers. We just pointed out challenges and suggestions.
Okay. I mean, I'm beginning to pick up some themes around this conference. One theme is, I was at a session yesterday where there was diversity, and they were being very nice about it and trying to be polite, but basically saying, we're business people, you universities, you can't really run education efficiently, we'll run the MOOCs for you and make money out of it. There's the Scandinavians, I saw a parallel actually yesterday, you were talking at a session, saying, we're free universities, we can use MOOCs to our advantage. How do you see that working? And more than that, they're disruptive within our institutions. How can we disrupt our own institutions and at the same time keep what I believe in, which is a free education system?
The thing about, if you come to the Scandinavian countries, we should actually develop MOOCs because we are already funded by the government, by public money. And if you develop MOOCs that goes out to the public so that everybody can get this education, why should it be limited to institutions? So we actually, I think, have a stronger incentive to develop MOOCs and to share our education, because it's the taxpayers, everybody who's paying our salaries to go there, to work and to produce this education.
And you told me yesterday, we're going to go soon, but I'm still intrigued by this, that you're going to disrupt Oslo's Business School. How will Oslo's Business School see you disrupting it?
I don't think I said I would disrupt it. I think that is pushing it a bit. But we are currently having a lot of pilots, and we are seeing how we can use technology to improve and update how we teach and how we learn, so that we are more in times with the changes and the challenges and how the students are evolving and modernizing. And instead of going with the old models, looking for new models where we reap the benefits of two worlds, the online world and the on-campus world.
I could talk to you for the rest of the morning about this, but there's other guests here, and Serge Rave is waiting there very patiently for the last 10 minutes. So thank you very much, and we'll keep this discussion going because I'm intrigued what will happen to Oslo's Business School in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for letting me come.
Serge, good to have you here.
Hi, Jenny. Very pleased to be with you today.
Yesterday, we had a colleague, a friend of yours, Eric Rousseau.
Yes.
And he gave us a great introduction to what badges were all about. And for me, it was brilliant because I kind of heard the words, but I didn't really know the ins and outs and how they worked. So he told us what they were. He told us how they worked. Really popular subject here at the conference. So you're back with us today to follow up on this and hopefully tell us a bit more detail, what the issues are. Because there must be problems. There must be things that we are going wrong that we don't know about.
Badges are really statement of trust. A badge tells, I trust you for doing this, the criteria you will find in a badge, based on the evidence you have provided. So badges are really statements of trust, criterion-based trust statements. And this is something that most people forget about badges. They will see the picture, and they will think, okay, I want to collect badges because they will look nice on my homepage, on my Facebook account. But if you take a badge, for example, let's say that we get a badge because we were on Educa Berlin. This badge, in fact, doesn't represent just the fact that I was at Online Educa Berlin, but we were all at Online Educa Berlin. So you could imagine that we could use a badge as a means to send an email to all the people who share the same badge. So the badge is a connector between people as well. So it's not just the pretty picture you would put on your Facebook account. It is a trust statement, and it is a connector between people, which is also a connector with ideas, because Online Educa is not just an event like any other. It's about learning technologies. So it connects me and all the people here to learning technologies. So imagine that we collect hundreds and hundreds of badges. We would be able to build a very deep picture of the individuals. For example, yesterday, during a workshop, someone complained, raised a very valid question about inflation of badges. What happens if you receive 1,000 badges or 10,000 badges? If you think a badge as a badge, as a picture, it is a problem. But if you think of the badge as a trust statement, would it be a problem to have an inflation of trust?
Fair comment. I hadn't thought of it like that. Keep going, because this is really good stuff.
So I don't know what else to say, but I think this is the main value of badges. And so the problem we have today with the current development of badges infrastructure is that there is an asymmetry between the badge issuers and the badge receivers. That is basically, you are either a badge issuer, an organization generally, and a badge recipient. And so when you draw a picture where you have the badge issuer at the center and the recipients around the learners, it is obvious that the open badge infrastructure today is not learner-centered.
No, it's very much issuer-centered, isn't it?
It is issuer-centered. So how can we reverse that? And that's why with Eric, was there yesterday, we are developing the idea of the open passport as a place where you will be able to issue and receive badges, and where we'll be able not only to have what I call today silos of trust, but network of trust. And from this network of trust, I hope we'll be able to find innovative way to address one issue I have for many years. When in the same sentence you put recognition of learning, recognition of informal learning, it is always assumed that it is formal recognition of informal learning. What we could be able to do with badges is put on a par informal recognition of informal learning and formal recognition of informal or formal learning. So basically, to use the networks, the trust networks, the community of badge holders as the trust issuers. And I think that will really change the relationship between grading. Basically, we'll be able to abolish grades, because the recognition by the peers will have more value than the recognition by some external entity.
Do we trust communities of practice not to abuse the trust that the badges are putting in them? I mean, that's an issue for me. Maybe I'm being mistrustful, but I do know, for instance, not badges, but on LinkedIn, you can rate people and give them, you know, accreditation or recognition for certain things. Do you think people will abuse the trust?
I think you can abuse LinkedIn, because LinkedIn is a big farce. Basically, it is you pat my back, I'll pat your back.
Exactly.
With a badge, you have a trust relationship. You know who has issued the badge. So you will know that this person has a credential to issue the badge. And what will happen if the person receiving the badge has a bad reputation, that will trickle back to the person who issued the badge. While it doesn't happen at all in LinkedIn. So with networks of trust, trust will trickle down and up the network of trust.
Serge, I'm going to have to stop now, because I can see Stephen over there. I'm looking forward to talking to him too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And hopefully see you next year.
Oh, what a show it is today. It's always a bit of a problem the night after the Online Educa Social. And one of our later guests has just told me he had to close the bar last night because it was so late and no one else would do it. But anyway, Stephen Downes is here. It's a pleasure again. I think we interviewed once on Sounds of Bizarre before. And Jen's going to talk to Stephen about, I think, education and the world, I think, because it's a limited choice. Okay, on the sofa, the purple sofa at Online Educa, Sounds of the Bizarre.
I'm going to talk to Stephen Downes about being Stephen Downes, actually. Probably one of the better known, if not the best known names in e-learning. So what I really want to do, how do you keep generating ideas? How do you keep churning this stuff out? How do you stay at the front of e-learning, which is where you really are?
I do it every day, I guess. I think my newsletter helps a lot because it forces me to read every day. I do 5 to 8 items or whatever. Oh, yesterday I did 2, but sometimes it's not all there. But I think, yeah, just getting into the habit, you know. Other people take a walk in the morning, other people, they jog or whatever. I do my newsletter.
Probably one of the best read newsletters in e-learning, certainly. I actually read it. I read a lot. So, okay, let's go back in history. How did you get into this in the first place?
Completely by accident. My formal training is as a philosopher. And what happened was when I moved to Edmonton, Alberta, I got a job with Athabasca University. They asked me to do distance education for them. So I was a tutor for them for 7 years. I got involved in computer projects. I got onto the internet by accident. I played online games. And then eventually I was living in a cabin in the woods in northern Alberta. And I got a job working at Assiniboine as an instructional designer. And I took it from there.
And the rest is history. So, as somebody who has actually seen e-learning develop from very, very early days, where do you think we're going next?
Well, in my talk today, I talked about personal learning, and I think that that's the direction we're going next. What we've seen in e-learning so far has been massification, commoditization, right? Teaching to big classes, teaching the same content to a whole bunch of people. But what we really need and what we're moving toward is personal learning delivered personally, defined by the individual themselves. You know, and it's like Alvin Toffler predicted back in the 1970s, right? The era of mass customization. Except it's not customization, it's custom learning, designed specifically for the person.
Do we actually have the skills and technology to do this? I mean, how's it going to work?
We have some of the technology. We have the capacity to develop what we need. It's not beyond the imagination. There are some hard problems. You know, how do you make a system work where, you know, your data and your people are separated across, you know, 1,000 or 1,000,000 sites? But, you know, the internet has already solved that problem on one level, and this is the same problem on another level.
Turning it around a bit, what things depress you about the way that e-learning is going? What do you think are the big problems? What are things you get cross about?
What do I get cross about? I get cross about so many things. I'm turning into a curmudgeon in my young age. I get cross about advocates of open content insisting that we use CC BY licenses so that people can commercialize our stuff. That makes me angry because that wasn't the reason why I wrote it, and I don't want people to charge money or prevent access to it. So that's one thing, I think. What else? There's so much that's good, right? It's hard to get cross about things. I get cross about the reaching of the fine line between education and propaganda. And that's especially the case when people say, you know, we need education to get this message out, or we need education to promote this value. That's not the purpose of education. I know historically there has been this link, and people see education as a tool to creating a society in their own image. But really, I think education serves people better if it serves the needs of the person who is receiving or taking the education, if it helps people, you know, as John Stuart Mill said, pursue their own good in their own way.
It's a great quote to end up with. Graham is making noises at me over there, so I need to stop. Mm-hmm. Please come back and talk to us next year. Always good to see you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sounds of the Bizarre live Online Educa Berlin, the second day of Online Educa, and we're slowly coming to the end of this show, sadly. And in fact, we were talking, I think it was Stephen who actually said to us, you should have a 4-hour slot, you should have rolling radio. I'm thinking, oh my God, when will I ever get coffee if we do that? But every year, we like to have one of our friends on the radio. And this year, that privilege has gone to Nick Kearney. And I was talking to Jen yesterday about what Nick Kearney was talking about. And we looked at the programme for the conference, and there was something about, I don't know, what was it? People, something wild. We decided we didn't know what the hell Nick Kearney was talking about at the conference, so we'd have him on the radio to tell us what it was. But congratulations, Nick, on getting such a abstract title through the reviewers.
Yeah, the first thing you can do is tell us what the title was and then explain what it means.
I can't even remember it.
It was something night. About emotions, relationships, and no, online about, something.
The talk was about how in digital society, with all of our communication mediated with digital technologies, things like words like trust, identity, responsibility, gender, fairness, etc., they're shifting their meanings. And we know that's happening, but we don't know how that's happening. And it's an extraordinarily complex thing to research, because everybody has their own story. Everyone has their own account. You've got your evangelists like, I don't know, Facebook and Amazon and so on, saying this is brilliant and everything's amazing. And others like, I don't know, Andrew Keen, who was here a few years ago, Susan Greenfield, people like that who see a lot of dangers in these changes. But nobody actually has a clear, justified account of what's happening. They're just a series of different explications. And we, looking at that, we see it as a raft of different understandings that don't mesh together, and that in order to find a way through that, it's necessary to look at doing research in a different way. The old way of sitting back and saying, here's your control group, here's our observer viewpoint, totally independent, is not possible, because we're all within this ecosystem of communication and conceptions and ideas and so on. And therefore we need to go for a more qualitative approach that's based... The idea is based on a mixture of mass observation. I don't know if you know about that in the 1930s in the UK, which was basically a kind of anthropology of ourselves. People, everyday people, mind, making accounts of their everyday lives and their understandings and so on. We want to get back to that, and we also want to apply social ecology to it. Understand the whole thing as an ecosystem. That in which, if you don't understand the relationships between different elements in the system, you won't understand what's going on, and that you need to look at the relationships in order to understand the changes that are taking place. In order to do this, we've set up a thing called the Boundaries Observatory, where the aim is to do research and to discuss research, but with a special emphasis on making sure that there is not just an academic focus, that there's a whole bunch of participants who are just citizens doing citizen science and interpreting what their results are, what their understandings are, for the benefit of everyone. And we have a series of tools that we want to use, data visualization tools, that will look at the relationships between different explanations, trying to get to some kind of common understanding. Is that enough?
Oh, that was a good start. I haven't finished with you yet. Okay, so I understand what the words mean, I understand what the research is about and the methodology, and I know it's early days, but intrigued, has anything come out of it yet?
No, we're just beginning. This is something that we've been talking about, a group of us, for at the moment. The organisations that are starting it are My Tiny Company and the University of Salamanca and the University of Bolton. But we're talking to a whole range of other universities, such as Oldenburg, such as Tel Aviv. We're talking to the Malik organization in Switzerland. And there's a lot of interest. And at the present, we're just trying to put it together, because we want to do it from the grassroots upward. And one of the challenges, of course, finding a whole load of funding to sort of have somebody to organize things and structure things and manage the website and so on. But at the moment, what this is the beginnings of a research agenda, shall we say. But it's just in its infancy. We're sort of presenting it here, really, at EDICA.
Are you expecting there to be massive cultural differences between countries, between nationalities? I mean, that strikes me, maybe jumping the gun, but you've got possibly three countries involved. Mm-hmm. But do you think all of the stuff that you've been talking about, is that going to have huge cultural differences, or are you predicting there will be a similarity?
I think you get layers of difference and similarity. There's clearly a kind of web culture that is... It's international and it's spread right across Europe and right across the world, I would say. But then you have local variants of that, local differences in understandings. It's interesting that I did research like this for my doctorate, and I was researching in three different countries, in Mexico, the UK and Spain, which are quite sort of radically different contexts. And what was interesting was that common stuff did bubble up, but there were also a whole lot of things that were very much localized understandings that you didn't see in the three different places. But there was enough common stuff to actually draw out a series of quite useful conclusions, recommendations to policy and so on. Trouble is, no one listens.
I'm intrigued. I want to be involved in this.
Well,
I mean, how
play.
Do we come and play with you? I mean, this is my next question.
We have a website which explains all of this in much more detail, in quite dense detail, actually. It's quite strange. Most websites is very simplistic these days, and ours is a chunk of text and another chunk of text. But it's the boundary. It's all one word, boundariesobservatory.org. Written boundaries as in English, and there you find all the information, and there's a form to actually sign up and express your interest if that's what you'd like to do.
Good late night reading.
Exactly.
Well, I've got a spare day, I'll read it next. Thanks okay. Ever so much.
Thank you.
See you later.
Sounds of the Bazaar. Live Sounds of the Bazaar from Online Educa, Berlin. And that's it for another year. The years slip by, the radio shows come and go. My view, this year was some of our best ever radio from Online Educa. Is that because e-learning is advancing and becoming great? I rather think not. I think it's just the brilliance of the people on our sofa, the brilliance of our crew. Many thanks to Jen, who's been doing most of the interviewing. Artemis, who has been running and running and running and has got much fitter trying to find people. And Dirk, who probably hasn't got much fitter, sitting behind the deck, slowly turning the dials on our aging sound deck. And so that's it. And we'll see you again next year. This is Graham Atwell signing out from Sounds of the Bazaar Live.